This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Eric spearheads Sightline's work on energy policy. He has published more than 200 articles, reports, and analyses on a range of issues connected to fossil fuel transport, including carbon emissions, local pollution, transportation system impacts, rail policy, and economics. Eric DePlace is here today to tell us about the environmental implications of fracked fuel and petrochemical projects in the Pacific Northwest and to give us an update on the status of Northwest coal and oil terminals. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Diane. I appreciate being back.
In your writings, you speak about the thin green line. Would you explain?
Sure. The thin green line is the notion that the Pacific Northwest has been put in the bullseye of the international coal and oil economy. And what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years is that an unprecedented number of coal, oil, and natural gas projects have been proposed for this region to export huge quantities of fuel, mostly to Asian markets. But what the thin green line is supposed to indicate is that there is a potential for this stretch of the Northwest coast to act as a barrier, to act as a globally very significant dam, essentially holding back these carbon fuels and preventing them from entering the world markets and being combusted. So there's sort of a lot packed into that name, but it is supposed to be evocative both of the threat and opportunity that this region faces.
Let's focus now on fracked fuel and petrochemical projects in the Pacific Northwest. Before we go into more detail, would you give a brief overview of the fracked fuel and petrochemical projects being proposed?
Sure. So these are a suite of projects, frankly, of fuels that most people are unfamiliar with. I think people in general have some limited understanding of coal. It's a basic understanding that it's a fuel we dig up out of the ground and we combust it mostly for electricity burning. Oil, similarly, we usually drill that and then we refine it and burn it in our cars and our airplanes and so forth. This third wave in the tsunami of projects that's come our way has been mostly related to natural gas and some of the curious byproducts of other fossil fuel extraction. And so the name I gave it is fracked fuels and petrochemicals. I realize that's a bit of a mouthful, but it's supposed to encapsulate this new generation of projects that we're facing, all of whom have very high carbon profiles, are often very dangerous simply from a health and safety perspective, and are a little bit more complex to understand than some of the previous coal and oil export projects that we've seen in this region. The biggest and most significant of this new wave of projects are what's called liquefied natural gas projects. What those do are take fracked natural gas, mostly from British Columbia, deliver it by pipeline to a facility on the coast that then, in a very energy-intensive process, turns that natural gas into a liquid form, radically condenses, and then that goes onto vessels and is exported to Asia. LNG is growing in significance globally. It's a big, big deal in the Pacific Northwest right now. On top of that, there are an array of other projects. I guess the only other one that's really worth mentioning in great detail right now because it's so significant is methanol refining. Methanol is a liquid petrochemical. It also, in the case of the Pacific Northwest projects, is supposed to be derived from natural gas. So again, you're fracking huge quantities of natural gas in British Columbia, delivering it by pipeline to a facility on the coast. And then in the synthesizing or refining process, you turn that natural gas into methanol, put that in a tanker vessel and ship it to China, where it would be used in making plastics or perhaps as a transportation fuel. So the large similarity here is both of these kinds of projects, if they were built as proposed, would result in a huge increase in natural gas consumption in the Northwest, along with a lot of fracking in Canada, and then many, many risks for our waters. There are a couple of other things going on as well, either related to plastics manufacturing. There are some, the industry calls them improvements, but they're not really improvements, changes in the way that we're going to be doing oil refining up in Anacortes that will create a product called xylene that's used to manufacture plastics, mostly in China. And then we have also seen the advent of very ill-advised proposals to ship essentially propane in large-scale trains and ship that through our cities, offload it into a facility, and then export it to China. It's extremely dangerous to ship propane that way.
What are the locations of the projects being proposed?
Well, most of the projects right now are on either Puget Sound or on the lower Columbia River. There are a couple of outliers. There's one down in Coos Bay that is about half dead at this point. Or rather, it died and is sort of coming back to life. But as with the coal and oil export schemes, most of what we're seeing in this third generation are on the Northwest's sort of most important water bodies. So we're looking at a xylene-producing project up in Anacortes at an oil refinery there. We're looking at a liquefied natural gas project in Tacoma. There was a big methanol refinery proposed for Tacoma that collapsed under intense political pressure. And so now, probably the biggest focus of activity is in the Lower Columbia River. So that's the downstream stuff from Portland, Longview, Kalama, that region.
Would you paint a picture of the infrastructure that would be needed to service these proposed facilities?
Yes. In some cases, we'd be looking at an increase in rail traffic, like we saw with oil trains. So there have been now three proposals, all of which have expired, thankfully, to move propane by rail. I expect that that will crop back up again. The industry is essentially swimming in propane and similar hydrocarbons that are light, and they don't have a natural sort of market for those right now. But by far the biggest impact of these projects in terms of infrastructure is in the construction of gas pipelines. And it's important for those who aren't sort of embedded in the energy sector to distinguish between gasoline that we put in our car, which is a liquid, and natural gas, which is, as the name suggests, a gas. We are familiar with it maybe for a cooking fuel in our homes if we have a gas stove, or some people heat their houses with natural gas. But we're talking about very large quantities of natural gas that would be delivered in new built pipelines that would basically thread their way down from the remote regions of Northeast British Columbia and to some of the population centers and port communities in Washington and Oregon. And then there'd be a big facility there to do something with that gas.
What are the environmental implications overall of these fracked fuel and petrochemical projects?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I tend to focus on sort of the climate and carbon impacts of these projects, and I think it's fair to say that most of them are a climate disaster. You know, I think the whole notion of fracking has been somewhat explored in the public consciousness, but it's an environmentally destructive and carbon-intensive way to extract fuel. It used to be that we talked about natural gas as being a cleaner source of fuel, or perhaps a bridge fuel from coal and oil to something better in the future. The science no longer really supports that case. At best, natural gas, when you consider the sort of upstream emissions that are associated with fracking, at best, it's a tiny bit better than coal, and at worst, it's no better, maybe even worse than coal. So this really is not an environmentally sustainable enterprise. And then on top of the carbon risks, of course, there are very serious risks. Liquefied natural gas, for example, is highly explosive. We know that natural gas, even in a gaseous state, is highly explosive. Certainly anyone who's familiar with the Greenwood explosion in North Seattle knows that just how dangerous this stuff can be. What happened in Greenwood is actually just a very, very small example of a risk that could be magnified many, many times beyond a sort of, you know, residential feeder line like that. We're talking about 3-foot diameter gas pipelines that would be traveling through communities. And so there are plenty of folks who are worried not even so much about the environmental risks, but simply about the risks of a large-scale explosion, particularly in the event of a terrorist attack or an earthquake or, you know, some objective hazard like that.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Our topic is the environmental implications of fracked fuel and petrochemical projects in the Pacific Northwest and the status of Northwest coal and oil terminals. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. How do the fracked fuel and petrochemical projects compare overall with coal and oil terminals in terms of environmental consequences?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a little bit harder to get our hands around these. When we were first looking at coal and oil export projects, you know, one of the things that I did, I'm a full-time number cruncher and researcher, was I tried to sort of add up how much carbon would have been embedded in those projects. So on an annual basis, if those projects had been built, and actually most of them were ultimately defeated, a few were still standing, but if they had been built, they would have been the climate equivalent of 5 to 8 Keystone XL pipelines, just in Oregon and Washington and British Columbia. So an enormous increase in carbon delivery infrastructure in a relatively small region. When we add on to that accounting this whole new world of fracked fuels and petrochemicals, then, you know, we're talking about, depending on how you do the math and what assumptions you make, adding another Keystone or two of additional infrastructure here. So it's very significant, but it's a little bit harder to say because the nature of the fuels themselves is to a degree unclear, and also the end use is a little bit unclear.
Would you now go into more detail about the liquefied natural gas projects that are under consideration in the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah. So when I wrote the report that we're talking about today, there were sort of three interesting ones proposed in Oregon and Washington, one big one down at Coos Bay. That project was actually denied federal permits, but the project backers are coming back again, and they may be able to resurrect that project. It would be an enormous export project. It probably economically is dubious at best, but they're going to give it a go. There was another extremely large, I think it would have been the largest LNG export project anywhere in North America, maybe in close to one of the biggest in the world. That was at Astoria. That project did finally collapse and die under sustained attack by the local community there and by grassroots activists. And there were some other problems with it as well. But that was a very, very serious project that was fought valiantly by the local folks down there. There's still a liquefied natural gas project proposed at Tacoma. That's actually not an export project. It's a differently constructed one, but raising very serious concerns in Tacoma because of its physical location, which would be basically right in the middle of the city. It would sit on what they call the tide flats, so in the port district right downtown. And because LNG is so notoriously dangerous, it can explode under the wrong circumstances, there are lots of folks who are worried about it being so close to people.
So the Tacoma facility is the only one of the projects that's currently looking to actually go forward.
That's right. It's much smaller than the others, but also because it's situated in such a dense urban area, is particularly contentious for many of the folks in that community. I guess the one thing to mention that's sort of new since I wrote this report is we have taken a closer look at what's going on in British Columbia. And British Columbia is, at this moment, considering, I think, 20 or 21 liquefied natural gas export projects. Not all of those could possibly make it across the finish line, maybe only one or two. Ultimately, well, we don't know. But it now looks like it's kind of the beating heart of the liquefied natural gas industry across North America is no longer the Gulf Coast. It's going to be British Columbia. They have huge natural gas reserves in the interior and a provincial and federal government that appears to be pretty amenable to building large-scale pipeline and export infrastructure for it. So that's a real serious concern, I think, for a lot of folks.
And how are BC citizens responding to these proposals?
Well, it's tough. They are fighting two huge oil pipelines as well. The environmental community and many citizens have been also putting up a very good fight against some of these projects. Permitting in Canada works differently than it works in the United States. It's actually harder to obstruct a project there. And so we are fortunate so far that none of these projects have actually been completed yet. I think the outcome is highly uncertain. Thank goodness there are staunch opponents in the First Nations, the tribes that they have in British Columbia, and the environmental community has been certainly doing the best that they can.
Let's take a look in more detail now at petrochemicals, specifically methanol. Tell us again what methanol facilities are being proposed.
Yeah, so there are three methanol proposals, all backed by the same company. It's called Northwest Innovation Works. It's actually an arm of the Chinese government, of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. These are very large capital-intensive projects, billions of dollars apiece, and they are designed to take natural gas, convert it into a liquid petrochemical called methanol, and then export that to China, where it would be used to make plastic products. There's a couple of other stages in that process, but basically it's natural gas to liquid methanol and then into plastics. The biggest methanol project in the world, by a long shot, was proposed for Tacoma. That became an extremely vicious political fight in that city. And that project was ultimately withdrawn by the project backers. So a huge victory for the environmental community. There are two remaining methanol projects now, one at Kalama, Washington, on the Columbia River, which is very close to getting approval. And then another project, which is farther out in a little town called Klatskanai on the Oregon side of the Columbia.
Say a little bit more about the Kalama facility. What is it going to be like? What is actually proposed specifically there?
Sure. So now that the Tacoma project is gone, the project at Kalama would be the biggest methanol producing facility anywhere in the world. So we're talking about very large projects here. And what they would be doing is building new gas pipeline infrastructure to deliver huge quantities of natural gas. They would be putting more natural gas into that site than is used in every gas-fired power plant in the state combined, more than every business in the state uses combined. So it's an enormous project simply from delivering huge quantities of gas there. Then there would be basically a methanol refining facility built on the banks of the Columbia River that would take all that gas, synthesize it into a liquid petrochemical, and then put that on tankers, about 3 to 6 per month, and then those would travel down the Columbia and take the product to China. What is concerning about the Kalama project is not only you're creating large quantities of a rather toxic petrochemical and risking the Columbia River, but that project probably acts as a Trojan horse for building out natural gas infrastructure that will serve a variety of purposes in Washington and lock us into another 50 or 60 years of fossil fuel dependence. And so there are sort of nested concerns. One is the particular facility at Kalama, because it's such a dangerous petrochemical that it only goes to create more plastic products we probably don't need. But the larger concern, in my view, is that it becomes the sort of cause for locking us into serious fossil fuel dependence for decades to come. And we need to focus a lot more on that, because the industry has not been honest even remotely about the scale of their ambitions there.
Why is the Northwest and Kalama being chosen for methanol manufacturing?
Yes, this is a question that I wish people asked more often. It's not just that we're close to Asia, although that has something to do with it. Principally, what's at work is the Northwest offers cheap natural resources. So when the Chinese government, in the case of the methanol facilities, comes looking and proposes all these projects, it is because we have cheap natural gas available, very, very cheap natural gas available from British Columbia. We have cheap electricity supplies, some of the cheapest in the nation, easily. And we have abundant water relative to other regions. And all of those products, you need a lot of electricity and a lot of water and a lot of natural gas to create methanol. And so simply from a cost perspective, they look to places like the Pacific Northwest and say, well, we can get all these resources for super, super cheap. And then we can take that to China and use that to manufacture plastic products. So in many respects, the industry is treating the Northwest as a resource colony, where they look to us and say, well, they've got cheap natural resources. We're going to take those and produce something, in my judgment, pretty nasty with it. Now, they have dressed up their projects in kind of green language, and they like to say, well, we're doing this for environmental reasons, or this is going to be the cleanest and greenest in the world, which turns out not to be true. But they've adapted sort of to the way that we talk in the Northwest, which is to put some green lipstick on it. But the reality is that these are driven almost solely by economic factors.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Our topic is the environmental implications of fracked fuel and petrochemical projects in the Pacific Northwest and the status of Northwest coal and oil terminals. What is the current status of the proposed facility at Kalama? How far along is it?
It's unfortunately pretty far along at this point. They have completed what's called the final environmental impact statement, which is normally the last thing that happens before a project begins to get the permits that it needs for construction. That document, the environmental impact statement, is now being challenged. There will be some litigation around that. And then that project will need to obtain federal, state, and county permits in order to start construction. So we are getting to the 10th or 11th hour on that project. We need the state to take a much harder look, in my judgment, at the merits of that project. It is possible for the state to deny permits to build it. But I think as important, as I suggested earlier, is that the state demand the industry reveal more about its plans for building out gas infrastructure, because it requires so much natural gas to serve this plant. There are many, many folks who study the energy flows who think that what will actually happen is that the gas industry will use this as a reason, and they appear to have some good evidence for this, to build out huge networks of natural gas pipelines and delivery systems that will effectively make it possible to build new gas-fired power plants, that will maybe make it efficient enough to build new liquefied natural gas projects when the economics come back on those, or to build other methanol projects. And so the public needs a much clearer accounting of just how much new pipeline infrastructure we're talking about. What they will tell you if you ask them is that they're only building a few miles of just one little extender, but that's actually not accurate if you think about kind of the entire network systems of moving that much gas, because it's an absolutely staggering quantity of gas that they would have to get down to the lower Columbia River.
To what extent is the local community in favor or not in favor of the project?
You know, I don't know that I've seen recent public opinion polling about that project. I'm actually going to be down in Kalama November 14th and 15th. Doing some talks down there. There are lots of folks who are very unhappy with it. You know, and I think it is fair to say that, as with some of the other projects, these things don't look real good to the local community. They offer very few jobs. They offer all kinds of downside risk, everything from toxic spills to flammability to simply making the region economically undesirable. I mean, there are not that many people who want to locate a business or locate a home into the shadows of a giant petrochemical refinery. And that's what the industry wants to do is, you know, basically build out epically large petrochemical sites very near where people live. And so, as you can imagine, there are folks who are concerned about the environmental impacts of these projects, some folks who are concerned about the carbon and climate impacts of these projects, and a lot of folks who may not care as much about any of that, but simply don't want to be poisoned. So when I spend time in those communities, I am often really surprised at the number and variety of reasons why people are either concerned or opposed to these kinds of projects. And I think, honestly, I mean, there are dozens of reasons why people should be worried about them. So, you know, everyone sort of gets at the issue in a slightly different way. And I think a lot of it's, you know, really legitimate.
So looking at all of the fracked fuel and petrochemical projects, which ones are very close to going forward? The Kalama one you've just been talking about. Well, what other ones are on the verge, as it were?
So of the fracked fuels projects, the project to Kalama is the nearest to completion. Probably the second nearest is the liquefied natural gas project I described at Tacoma. There's still some more to play in that game, but that one's getting close. And then in Anacortes at the Tesoro refinery there, this is in the North Puget Sound, there is a proposal to basically enlarge that refinery, add what's called a xylene extraction unit. It's a $400 million project that would create this niche refining product that would go to plastics manufacturing in Asia. That one is also getting pretty far along. There are not too many opportunities to obstruct it, but there are some. And so I would urge folks who are interested in the North Sound and the San Juan Islands to think really seriously about that project. Xylene can be difficult to contain in a spill environment. It's toxic and hazardous to people. And then also, of course, I think there's an argument for simply not continuing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars expanding our existing oil infrastructure so that we can create ever more petrochemicals. We don't need them anymore.
So coal and oil terminals are also still at play in the Northwest. What's happening with the coal projects? Would you give us an update on proposed coal terminals?
Yes. So I first kind of got into this line of work in 2010, 2011. And by this line of work, I'm referring specifically to fighting fossil fuel infrastructure projects. But I first got into this at that time because the Northwest was being inundated with coal export projects. We had six proposed in Oregon and Washington, several expansions proposed in British Columbia, and it's been a smash success. We have beaten every single one of those proposals. Not one has been built. There is one giant one still standing. It's at Longview, Washington, which is very near Kalama, actually. It would be the biggest coal export project anywhere in North America. And economically, that thing is probably already a goner, but the project is still shambling forward. And so it is critical that we stop that project before it gets built out, because we don't want an outlet for 44 million tons of cheap, pointless coal from Wyoming.
And what's the current status of oil terminals?
Oil terminals has actually been a similar sort of success story, where we originally were looking at, I think, 14 oil by rail projects. Counting them gets a little bit challenging, but of all of the projects that we fought, we stopped every single one of them. And by we, I don't mean me so much as a huge network of tribes and First Nations and environmental and grassroots activists and all kinds of people, businesses all over the region. But there is one very big one left, and it's at Vancouver, Washington, again on the Lower Columbia River. It would be the biggest oil by rail project anywhere in North America, maybe in the world. So if there's a theme running through here, you can get the sense that the Northwest could potentially be home to the biggest fossil fuel projects on the planet. I mean, that's what's at stake here. That project now, they have completed the analysis on it. It will go to the governor's desk in a couple of months, probably, and the governor will make an up or down decision about the fate of that project. It's extremely risky from an environmental perspective. It's huge quantities of oil, absolutely unnecessary. It's a terrible, terrible project on the merits. If you gave me time, I would rant about that project for a month. It's a horrible idea, and I do hope that Governor Inslee denies that project and prevents it from moving forward. That's something that his constituents can, you know, make their opinions known about, I'm sure.
What factors have been behind the dropped or rejected fossil fuel projects?
That's a great question. You know, I wouldn't say that there is just one or two factors. There are a multitude of factors that have affected these. For one, we've seen extremely important opposition from the Northwest tribes. The Lummi get much deserved credit for blocking a huge coal export terminal up in Whatcom County. They were able to stop that under very ferocious odds. So the tribes have played a huge role. There has been, I think it's fair to say, the largest sustained environmental movement in the history of the Northwest. We've had hundreds of thousands of comments, thousands of people showing up to PAC hearing rooms. That stuff has mattered and has slowed these projects down, tangled them up in permitting and delays, and ultimately stopped a whole bunch of them. We've seen very effective litigation. We've seen very effective financial side attacks, with those of us in opposition to the projects able to get investors and Wall Street to back away from these projects. They're bad reputationally. They're bad investments. They're stupid for the planet. So the financial side attacks and the economics have mattered as well. And, you know, every community has its own dynamics, its own politics, its own history, its own culture. And every proposed fossil fuel project has its own dynamics. And so, you know, somewhere in the intersection between the dynamics of the project and the dynamics of the community, there's usually a way to figure out how to trip these things up and stop them, even when they're Goliaths. They always have an Achilles heel.
What is your prognosis for fossil fuel projects in the Northwest? What do you think will happen over the next few years?
Well, I'm starting to get confident these days. You know, back in the day when we first looked at the sheer number of these projects and we counted up 5 to 8 Keystone XLs worth of new carbon delivery mechanisms in the Northwest, I was worried. I was very bearish about our ability to stop them. I think history has shown, demonstrated clearly, that the Northwest can fight and win every single one of these projects. We can stop them all. You know, and I think recently of the fight that happened in Tacoma, you know, that was a, I think it was a $3.4 billion project It had the support of the governor. It had the support of a huge array of businesses. And in a ferocious and at times, I think, vitriolic debate, it went down in flames. And the project backers pulled away because they knew that they could never get that project built in Tacoma. So with the right kind of, frankly, ferocious, sustained citizen opposition, it is entirely possible to take on the biggest and nastiest industries on the planet and stop them in their tracks. That's the story of the Thin Green Line, is Oregon and Washington and British Columbia going toe-to-toe with these giants and saying, no, we're not going to allow this stuff to happen. We're going to chart a different course for ourselves and honestly for the world, too.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
You know, the message is, and this can sound too optimistic in an age of cynicism, but I really do believe this, and history really has borne it out. We actually do have the power. We have everything that we need now to chart a new, better course toward a cleaner energy future and toward a carbon-stable future. That requires doing two things: building the new clean energy economy and also stopping the bad stuff. We have to stop the coal and oil and gas projects, or we're going to be in serious trouble. And we know now that we can do it. We know that we have the tools to do it. And we should never assume that just because a project looks like everything is baked for it, we have the ability to stop it.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Eric.
Diane, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You are just listening to Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. For more information, check on the web at sightline.org. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.